You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, think of the last time you put some ice in a beverage. Probably pretty recently, given our summer heat. For me, this morning in my coffee, last night in a mocktail. Did you stop to think about how convenient it is that you have ice on demand? It's probably always been that easy to cool off a drink, right? Well, not so fast. There's a centuries-old story about how we came to use frozen water as a commodity in the U.S. and around the world. It even involves some good old-fashioned hardball business practices right here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you ever had to go without ice or without refrigeration, how did that affect you and your food and beverage choices? How do you use ice in your day-to-day life? Big fan of skating rinks, say? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy Brady is executive director of Orion Magazine, a contributing editor for Scientific American and co-editor of The World As We Knew It, Dispatches from a Changing Climate. Her new book is called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
What motivated you to stop taking ice for granted and tackle it in this book?
A few years ago, there was a heat wave that gripped the planet, and I was visiting family back in my home state of Kansas. The heat wave knocked out the power into our to their house, and so we piled into their car and went to a nearby gas station that was operating on a generator. Inside, there was air conditioning, there was a soda machine, and I filled a cup with ice to try to cool down. And as I was watching that ice fall into my cup, it just occurred to me that I hadn't thought twice about whether ice would be available. I just knew if I went to that gas station, I'd find it. Or if I went the other direction to the nearby grocery store, I could have bought a bag of ice. And I wondered, why is that the case? Why is ice available everywhere? Because it really isn't in other places around the world. Well, when I got home and the electricity came back on, I tried to do some research to find an answer to that question, and I couldn't find a satisfying answer. So I decided to look more in depth, and ultimately a fascinating history of how ice on demand came to be started to reveal itself. And that was the premise for this book.
Now, back in the day, you could have ice if you were rich and lived in a place that had frozen ponds or rivers nearby. You dig into the story of the first ice entrepreneur in the United States who ends up shipping ice to the Caribbean. Can you share a little bit of his story and how he made this an actual business?
Yeah, the first person to make ice into a business, he was the person who launched the American ice trade. His name was Frederick Tudor. He was a wealthy Bostonian. Some might have called him a madman. People did call him a madman in his day. And as a late teen and then a man in his early 20s, he landed on this idea to carve large blocks of ice out of his family's lake on their estate in Massachusetts and ship it to people who lived in warm climates around the world. And he just knew that once people got a taste of cold, they would never look back, and he would make millions of dollars. And it took years and years of trial and error, but that eventually was the case.
And it wasn't a gimme. The thing he had to do, the marketing technique he stumbled on, was to actually give ice free to bartenders, right, and say, hey, you can make cold rum drinks instead of room temperature rum drinks. How did that catch on?
That's exactly right. So one of the first places that he tried to sell ice to were people living in Cuba. And what he knew after years of failure there, he just couldn't get people to buy his ice, was that nobody in Havana trusted him, but they all trusted their local baristas. Cafe culture was dominant in Cuba. So he went to the local cafes and he said to the owners, look, I'm going to give you some ice for free. And that way you can use it to make these most delicious drinks. And then you can sell it to your customers at the same price as you would sell lukewarm drinks. And let's just see which one they like the best. Well, just as in today, back then, you really can't argue with a cold drink on the rocks. And people clamored for it. And he ended up making a killing.
Talking to Amy Brady about her new book, Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts on ice, its accessibility, its history. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was living in Lowell, and the bartender said that there was a tunnel underneath this bar, and we thought about what it could possibly be. Then I went and did a little bit of investigation. It was a tunnel from the river up through the bar to the brewery at the top of the hill, and they would take horses and cut big blocks of ice out of the river and take them up through the tunnel all the way from the brewery down to the river, and they put hay on top of them, and then they put the beer in there, and it lasted all summer.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing that story. Now, Amy, that wasn't the only place that was happening in Wisconsin. You write of an ice war in Milwaukee, where they were supplying ice to brewers, making cold German lagers there. What ended up happening?
This is one of my favorite stories that came out of my research. So, in the early 20th century, around 1900, 1901, there was a company harvesting ice out of the Milwaukee River that went by, ironically, as the Wisconsin Lakes Ice and Cartage Company. And Wisconsin Lakes was the only ice company in the region for years and years and years. But then that changed when another company came in called the Pike and North Lake Company that started harvesting ice out of Lake Michigan. Well, this was at the peak of the Industrial Revolution when rivers were really, really dirty. And so the Pike Company launched this smear campaign against Wisconsin Lakes that was harvesting out of the Milwaukee River, saying that their ice was really dirty. Well, Wisconsin Lakes didn't take kindly to that. So they looked at Pike Company's infrastructure to see, is there any way that we can get back at them? And sure enough, what they realized was that the Pike Company had bought land to build their ice houses close to the railroads, the same type of railroads that was probably delivering ice to that bar that your caller just talked about. But what they had failed to do was to buy the land between the ice houses and the railroads. So Wisconsin Lakes ended up buying that intermediate land area. And then waited until Pike Company had harvested a bunch of ice and was ready to bring it to the railroads for delivery. And when they did that, Wisconsin Lakes slapped them with a trespassing order, and all of their ice went to waste. Well, the Pike Company decided this was war. And so what they did in retaliation was really one of the best acts of revenge I think I've ever read. What they did is that they waited until that Pike Company, excuse me, that Wisconsin Lakes was harvesting on for their next big delivery. Now, at the time, river tourism was pretty popular, and so what Pike Company did is that they bought a steamship and sold tickets to tourists. But what separated their steamship from all the other touristy steamships is that they outfitted theirs with an icebreaker. And so, right when Wisconsin Lakes was getting ready to harvest their ice, they filled the ship. They hired a band to play a jazzy tune, and as the band played, they brought their steamship right through the ice that Wisconsin Lakes was harvesting, sending the ice harvesters running and breaking that valuable ice into millions of splinters. It was really like Titanic in reverse.
Pretty cold-hearted. Now, Amy, before we enter the industrial ice era, I want to check out a historical character I didn't know existed. Now, we get to a point where people have ice boxes in their house. They get ice deliveries, right into their door. And there's this iconic figure of the sexy Iceman. Tell us about him.
So one of the most fascinating things I uncovered in my research was that by the time we get to the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, when ice delivery to people's homes was reaching its peak, we also find all of these popular songs with lyrics about housewives falling in love with the Iceman. I also found these vintage Valentine's Day cards with puns about the sexy Iceman. And I was wondering, why is this? Why was this nation fascinated with Icemen? Because they weren't the only delivery men of the era. There were milkmen, there were mailmen. But what I realized is that of all the delivery people of the era, the Iceman was the only one to come inside the house to bring their product to the kitchen. And they would often come into the house when the husband was away at work. And this was a time when there was a lot of anxiety around women being alone with men who weren't their husbands. And so this created a nationwide fascination and an anxiety around the Iceman. One of my favorite cultural finds was this song that was written in the 1930s that was later popularized by Ray Charles that went something like, I'm moving to the outskirts of town and I'm buying my woman a Frigidaire so we can get rid of that Iceman.
We're talking to Amy Brady, executive director of Orion Magazine. Her new book is called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about ice, how we used to get it, what led to the era of freezers in every home? Do you rely on ice for entertainment? Maybe that skating rink? Curling, for example. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Orion Magazine executive editor Amy Brady. We're talking about her new book. It's called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're big, it turns out, on ice here in the United States. I know I am. Have you traveled to someplace where ice wasn't really a thing? What was that like for you? Or are you from outside of the United States? Are you wondering, what's our deal with all the ice? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy, the creation of artificial ice, you know, not collected from nature, it changed our beverages, our food, a lot of other things. And another, you spent a chapter or two on sports, and this really shook things up, especially in the ways that women could be out doing sports in public. Can you talk about, you know, artificial ice surfaces and how they change things?
Absolutely. So ice skating was really popular in the early 19th century, even before we had indoor skating rinks. And one of the reasons why they were so popular was because young couples could enjoy ice skating outdoors together, spending time together, without being under the watchful eye of a guardian. Ice skating really was seen as the domain of young people, lest an older person fall and hurt themselves, or so went the thinking of the day. And so because it was so popular among young couples, women were encouraged to take part in the activity. And at the time, there were some, but not a lot of physical sports-like activities that women were encouraged to participate in. And so because women were ice skating, they had to consider how their garments affected their ability to stay upright on the slippery ice. And this was an era when women's skirts were very long. And so it was easy to trip on them. So they started hiking up their skirts and ultimately started buying clothing that was just a little bit shorter so that they wouldn't trip over their garments. And so in this way, ice skating led to changing social mores about women showing off their ankles and wearing shorter hemlines.
And then we had sports like curling and hockey that existed in some forms on frozen ponds before that, but the ability to create this surface, and not just when it was cold, how did it change those games?
Well, prior to indoor ice skating, sports like ice hockey and curling, though curling barely existed in the United States before indoor ice rinks. It was really just ice hockey and ice skating. Prior to the invention of indoor skating rinks, these were activities that were only experienced in northern climates where ice formed naturally. But once we had the ability to create indoor skating rinks, we could bring that popular pastime of ice skating that once only took place on, say, the Wisconsin, the Milwaukee River or the Hudson, could suddenly take place in Florida or Arizona. And that radically popularized sports. Now there are, ice skating rinks in almost every state in the union. And there aren't a lot of sports where you can say that it's, so popular that there are spaces dedicated to it in every single state.
Your book is bookended with a change in climate. Ice becomes less available at the end of the Little Ice Age. Rivers and lakes aren't freezing as much. And now there's concern. And an irony, you write, we're using a lot of energy to make ice to help us deal with the heat, but that in turn is contributing to climate change. Can you talk about some of those concerns?
Well, the popularization of ice and the need for cold, the American need for cold, led to the rise of electric refrigeration. And today, there are approximately 110 million electric refrigerators working in the United States alone. And a majority of those refrigerators have automated ice makers, which means that the refrigerator, which is already takes a significant energy draw, draws even more energy because those automated ice makers have motors that never turn off. That's why you can have ice at any time of day or night. Well, all of that energy use is starting to take a toll on the planet. The cooling industry contributes approximately 10% of all carbon emissions, which is means it's not the most significant contributor of global warming, but it's not insignificant. And as somebody who absolutely loves ice, I'm never giving up my ice. I love it. But also, as somebody who believes in living as gently on the earth as I can, I was curious to learn, are there experts thinking about this problem, and are there any solutions that might be possible in my lifetime? And I
And
was so excited to learn that there are people who are experimenting with technologies such as certain types of magnets, with a material called plastic crystals, which actually have nothing to do with plastic. It's a word that describes their structure, the molecular structure. They're learning that these materials can actually mimic the type of compression technology that more conventional refrigerators use that draw considerably less energy. And they also don't rely on the same type of traditional refrigerants that contribute to global warming that that conventional refrigerants do. So I'm very excited about this. If we can scale up that technology, that could be a game changer for the cooling industry. And gosh, if there's anything I've learned in writing this book, is that Americans can adapt new types of technology and make widespread transformations in a relatively short amount of time.
talking to Amy Brady about her new book called Ice. Let's bring on another caller. Laura is with us in Twin Lakes. Laura, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love the subject. And about in 2019, I took a trip to Alaska. And on one of the excursions, we were served glacial ice in our drinks. And it was just so totally awesome. It was like a blue white. And it was a great experience. Yeah.
Could you tell the difference in the drink, Laura?
It was just, but yeah, I think it was partly just in your head. You just realized it was so cold and delicious. I don't know.
Laura, thanks a lot for that call. Amy, that actually that brings me around to something you spent some time in the book, the aesthetics of ice in our drinks. And there people argue, I think, about the best shape of ice, the best source of ice to have in our cocktails. What do we know?
Well, the shape, the size, the texture of the ice that you put in your drink can radically change the flavor. Different sizes of ice dilute at different speeds. Some ice is actually just colder than other types of ice. And then there's also the way that ice looks. Ice straight out of a conventional ice machine is a little bit cloudy. in the center. And what some bartenders are thinking about is whether a clear ice can make a difference. And what their clientele is telling them is that yeah, it does make a difference. The drink tastes better, and to my mind, it also just looks better. And so when you go to an upscale cocktail bar in this day and age, don't be surprised if the ice in your cocktail looks extra fancy. And also don't be surprised if that cocktail costs a little more than you're used to, because super clear ice is pretty expensive.
Thanks for that call, Laura. And that takes me back to something early in your book, Amy. Now, the early blocks of ice you mentioned, towed by horses. Now, I've been in marching band back in high school, and I marched in parades behind horses. I know what comes out of the back of horses. This was an issue for our ice quality back in the day, right?
Oh boy, was it ever. So ice harvesters often employed horses to help cut the ice and then to haul it out of the lakes and rivers and into the back of wagons so that it could be delivered to people's homes. And as you say, you know, horses being the mammals that they are, often let loose their bowels on the ice, the very ice that would soon touch the mouths of thirsty Americans everywhere. And so all ice harvesting crews employed a man who would pull what was called a shine sleigh. And the job of the shine sleigh was to scrape the horse's waste off the ice so that it could be delivered. And it got its name from the oily shine that it would leave behind.
Yum. That's a great place to leave it. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Amy Brady, executive director of Orion Magazine. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can keep sharing your thoughts on ice. Do you have a favorite ice to put in a particular beverage? Let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, your name could say a lot about you. It might carry your reputation, your identity as an individual. You might be named after someone and feel that deeper connection to them. Your last name might say something about your family, maybe where your ancestors came from. Or you might change your name legally or informally in daily use to better reflect who you see yourself as, the perception you want to give off. Historically, name changes were often a way to avoid discrimination, but over time, people's motivations for changing their names have also shifted. Our next guest has spent more than a decade researching name changes and ethnic identity to understand what our names say about us and why we might change them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed your name for one reason or another, first and or last, legally or just, you know, what people call you in person? Why did you want to change it? And do you know the story of your family's last name? Was it changed maybe in the early days of immigration? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kirsten Vermeiglich is a professor of history and Jewish studies at Michigan State University, where she researches the historical meanings and nature of ethnic identity. She's the author of several books. Her most recent is called A Rosenberg by Any Other Name, A History of Jewish Name Changing in America. Kirsten, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate your inviting me to be on this.
Now, you did some fascinating research for that book I mentioned. You look back now in New York, where so many immigrants started their experience in the United States, going back, looking over name-changing petitions in the U.S. for decades and decades. What inspired you to dig into those?
Oh, well, I usually say to people as a joke that when you have a name like Kirsten Vermeiglich, of course you're going to be interested in name changing.
And that's same with the ferrets of the world, by the way, but I stuck with it.
Yeah, no, and we actually have family members who've changed their names even more, and there's a whole firm part of my family. But no, I never changed my name. The name did used to be something long, slightly different. But it wasn't really. I mean, that played a role in it. I think I've always found names fascinating. But I'm also a scholar of American Jewish history and American history, and I have always been really interested in sort of the ways that people kind of use names to try to identify, particularly who's Jewish, you know, sort of ideas about sort of what a Jewish name is. And so I just thought it would be a really interesting place to go to kind of think about how people have defined their ethnic community and thought about who is and who's not in the community.
I have this notion in my head that there are so many people who came from Eastern Europe or Italy or you name it, and they hit Ellis Island, and that Ellis Island clerk simplified or Americanized their names. And according to your research, I guess not so much.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so my research, you know, I usually sort of say that genealogists and anybody who's really looked at Ellis Island kind of knows that this isn't the case, that it certainly was not a wide scale phenomenon. There's no evidence of it. If you look sometimes, I mean, it's hard to do this on the radio. I sometimes will do this visually. If you look at manifests, which people listening to the show might have done genealogy, and they might have looked at the ship manifest where their ancestors came in. And if you look closely at those, you'll see little check marks. People at Ellis Island, the officials at Ellis Island actually didn't take record. They didn't actually write down anybody's name. They actually checked your name against your ship manifest. And there were actually rules at Ellis Island saying you could not change a name. And in fact, American law, all the states in the United States are actually very flexible in their naming, in the ability to change your name. So even if an Ellis Island official did change your name, you could just change it back really easily and quickly and unofficially. So usually, you know, I and other scholars kind of want to emphasize that probably your name was not changed at Ellis Island, even though I know that's really disappointing and upsetting for people who've heard that story from families. And instead, what I found in my research is actually, if you look at name change petitions, so many people actually chose to change their names.
Let's talk about that. And in your research, you found that recent Jewish immigrants, or maybe even not so recent, changed their names, not just because they wanted to sound more American, but for very specific reasons. Discrimination. What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, I was really, and when I went into my research, I really didn't know what to find. Really, nobody else has done this research before me. There's very little research into name changing. So I really didn't know what to expect. And I was really, really surprised to see, I mean, my first experience in walking into the archive the first day, I walked actually into the courthouse, and they just showed me into this little tiny room that just had wall-to-wall boxes of name change petitions, and like huge numbers of them were all 1930s and 1940s, especially, just boxes and boxes. So not during an era of major immigration. And instead, sort of the largest numbers came in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, after immigration had actually slowed to a trickle. And so what was really interesting to see, so that was one thing that really surprised me. And the other thing that I hadn't really expected was how many Jewish surnames were being changed. Predominantly surnames, some first names too, but predominantly surnames. And it really matches up with the institution and sort of the spiraling of institutionalized anti-Semitism in the United States, which really rose in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s. And so I think it's really significant that all these Jews are changing their names at this time when they pay a penalty for having Jewish surnames or Jewish names at all. People sort of identify them and then won't give them jobs, won't let them into schools. And so I think that that was really significant that at that time, as people are experiencing this kind of discrimination, they're choosing to erase these names that kind of made them targets.
Talking to historian Kirsten Vermeiglisch from Michigan State University, looking at the history of name changes in the United States, why we change our names and how that changes over history. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story maybe about the evolution of a name in your family, an official name change, or how the pronunciation maybe changed over the years? Have you changed your name for some reason? What led to that? Join in at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kirsten, I imagine this must be an ambivalent moment for a lot of people historically. They would like to not be discriminated against. They'd like to get that job, so there's that incentive to change a name. But they might feel like, hey, what about this connection with, you know, my family and all of its history?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, what I wound up finding was a lot of both about sort of family history, but also about how people felt in the moment, their communities, right? So what I think a lot of people hadn't really looked at before, and what I think that I was able to find in my research, was that certainly in the Jewish community, there was a lot of ambivalence and actually kind of anger and frustration with Jewish name changers, especially after World War II, you know, after the Holocaust. There was a great deal of kind of frustration and anger even directed at people who had changed their names. So people who changed their names reported being made fun of by members of their community. I found a petition of a man who had changed his name, and when he wanted to get married, the family he was marrying into made him change his name back. They refused to allow their daughter to get married to the changed name. So there were a lot of movies and books and other kinds of cultural artifacts that, you know, sort of made fun of name changers or kind of made them the villains in the stories. I think there was a lot of and a lot of kind of family disquiet. You know, I interviewed a few people who talked about sort of anger and frustration, or just unhappiness that they had this name that had been changed and they hadn't known about it, you know, family secrets and things like that. So yeah, I think that it led to, I think, some disruption and really sort of pointed to some fissures within the Jewish community as people had different responses to anti-Semitism. They had different responses to sort of how to deal with the discrimination they were facing.
In that time period, did you see other communities seeing similar waves of name changes? I think in pop culture of the Untouchables movie, where a Giuseppe Petri becomes George Stone, was this happening with non-Jewish groups in New York?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And as I say, when I started doing the project, I actually thought I was going to see people of all groups changing their names. Maybe I didn't say that, but I should have. I didn't know what to expect. And I didn't necessarily think that it was going to be overwhelmingly Jews. And I most certainly did see Italians and Poles. I mean, it's New York, so it was inflected by the groups that are there. So a lot of Italians and Greeks, smaller numbers of people with Polish surnames. But I absolutely did see those. You know, one reason, certainly, there were many more Jews than there were those groups. And I think one reason for that is probably the kinds of jobs that Jews were looking for in comparison to other ethnic groups. Jews at that time, the 1920s and the 1930s, were predominantly looking for white or pink collar jobs. So clerks, women were looking for jobs as secretaries. And for a lot of other ethnic groups, Italians and Greeks, they might not have been looking for those kinds of jobs. Women would frequently stay outside of the paid workforce. Men were frequently looking for more working class jobs, maybe longshoreman jobs, union jobs. And those were jobs that at that time, you didn't need to fill out an application form. It's kind of weird to think about at this moment, but like the filling out of an application form and the way that your name might attract attention was really significant at this time in history. So Italians who might have changed their names, Poles who might have changed their names, they might not have felt that they needed to do so kind of legally and formally using these name change petitions. If they were looking for working class jobs, they might have gone to like another union member, right? And been like, you know, can you find me a job at the factory? Or they might have found a job by standing on a street corner, right? And, you know, sort of getting a job. Domestic servants might have found a job that way. So Jews, both because they're experiencing more discrimination and also because they're looking for white collar work, where they have to put their names down on a form in a way that other groups aren't. So I absolutely see, this is not to say that I think other groups were absolutely changing their names, but maybe not in so many numbers because they're not facing the same kinds of, you know, this rise of anti-Semitism, but also because they're looking for different kinds of jobs. And so they show up in the economy in different ways, and their names aren't necessarily attracting the same kinds of negative attention that Jews are at that time.
Let's bring on a caller. Kristen is with us in Middleton. Kristen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I'm trying to mess with the phone here. I grew up outside of Detroit, and my father had always told me, oh, we go way back in the history of Detroit, back to the 1700s, but our name was not always Hall. It was some French name. And as I got into genealogy, it's my brick wall. I didn't know where to go with that. And with the help of some angels and some help, I finally found out what our French name was. And in Canada, the name was Michel Batry, but when they would cross the border, across the river into Detroit, because of the discrimination, they would use their stepfather's name. Back in 1803, the Batry wife married a man named Benjamin Hall. Uh-huh. So when they crossed to Detroit, they became Hall. They go back to the Windsor area, and they were Batry. So back and forth with baptismal papers over there was Batry.
Wow. But Kristen, thanks a lot for sharing that, and I'm glad you solved that mystery. Kirsten, I don't know if you have a lot of Quebecois people showing up to your records in New York, but that kind of back home, we were still old name. Over here, we are new name, I guess, probably didn't just happen in Detroit.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a super fascinating story. Thank you so much for calling in. And it really does sort of show, I think, the significance of discrimination. I think so much of name changing, people sort of generally say, oh, people wanted to Americanize. But I think really thinking about the impact of discrimination on groups and the reasons, very practical reasons that people want to change names, I think that's a super important part of that story. And I think also another important part of that story is, yeah, wanting to keep connections to family. Right? People don't necessarily always want to just be remaking themselves and erasing their older family connections. They want to maintain those connections a lot of times. And so name changes is sometimes something that people see as very practical. And yeah, I mean, definitely there are super, definitely I found stories in New York of people who might have come and found, say, that their family members are using a different name, right? Their families have taken on a different name, and maybe they're living with that family, or their family has convinced them that this is, you know, a good name to take on in the United States, or they may themselves be experiencing discrimination, or they may feel that sort of to, you know, sort of present a level of kind of middle class respectability, right? If everybody in the family has that name, that it might be embarrassing for one last person not to have changed their name. So I think that there was some pressure there for people to take on the name that you know, other people had already taken on. So I think all of those kinds of factors play a role. I'm really so glad that you were able to find that too. I certainly talked to people who do genealogy and they can't figure out right where it came from. So that's wonderful that you were able to find that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kristen. We're talking to Michigan State University history and Jewish studies professor Kirsten Vermeiglich about why we change our names, how our names shape our identities, historical trends in why and when people change their names. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did your name change in your family's history, your last name? Have you changed your name? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Kirsten Vermeiglich. She researches ethnic identity as a professor of history at Michigan State University. She's with us today talking about the role our names play in our identities and why people change their names and why those reasons have changed over time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kirsten, the reason people have changed their names has changed over time. You followed other ethnic groups at different points in history. What kind of things have stood out to you?
Well, so, you know, much of the work, I mean, certainly and guided by what I saw in the archive, there was definitely this sort of phenomenon of Jews changing their names, say from like 1917 through the 1960s. And then Jews kind of fell out of the petitions, I think, as institutionalized anti-Semitism dropped out of the workforce. I think fewer people felt that they needed to change their names. But by the 21st century, the name changes remained pretty low. But then by 2001, in the years after 9/11, I saw a huge upsurge in name changing. The population of New York City changed. Far more people of color, people of Asian background, Latino, Black, Middle Eastern, North African peoples all moved into the city. And so by the years after 2001, by the 21st century, I really saw sort of an intense flourishing of name changing from all those different groups. Some of the ones that seemed sort of interesting to me were ones, I mean, there was no one group that kind of dominated, but there were a good number of Asian Americans changing their names in ways that were in some ways similar and some ways different from what happened earlier in the 20th century. And then also the case of Muslim Americans was also in some ways similar to what happened to Jews earlier, and then in some ways really, really different and really fascinating that sort of talks differently about what discrimination looks like today for different ethnic groups and people of color.
Did that post 9/11 wave continue for a long time, or was it a brief flare up of people with, Muslim sounding names changed their name just last for a couple years?
Yeah, no, I initially stopped my research I thought I would just stop with the 20th century. And then people said to me, you should really go look and see what happened after 9/11 to people with Muslim sounding and North African sounding names. And so I did. And I was really struck to see that in the years right after 9/11, that, you know, there was an upsurge in name changing among people who had names that sounded Muslim, people with names like Muhammad, people who had names like Osama, people with those kinds of names were changing their names in similar numbers, with a lot of the reasoning that sounded sometimes more explicit than what Jews had said earlier in the century. And sometimes that sounded exactly like what had happened earlier in the century. People worrying about not getting jobs, people worrying about not being able to get into school, people worried about sort of suspicion or anger or being embarrassed in front of, other people. I mean, really, sometimes really heartbreaking kinds of petitions. What I found striking was that the petitions did not stay as much of an upsurge. So by 2012, 11 years after 2001, I didn't see disproportionate numbers of people with Middle Eastern or North African names changing their names.
I want to bring on one more quick call before we run out of time. Sharon is with us in La Crosse. Sharon, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up a couple points about first names being very feminine or very masculine, and that people that are transgender, changing their names, and sometimes that name change can be public. It can be a public notice, or you can have a judge that'll help you change it privately.
I gotcha, Sharon. We just have a few moments left, Kirsten, but that seems like it'd be an interesting field for future research, people who are changing gender identity and legally changing their names.
Actually, I'm just going to be publishing an article about that, actually. I think that's a fantastic point, and I'm so glad you brought it up. In addition to sort of seeing more Muslim names or more Asian American names, I actually found large numbers of people who are transgender changing their names. And New York City, actually, in terms of talking about doing it privately instead of publicly, New York City began to waive. You used to have to do it publicly, but New York City began waiving it because so many people who are transgender were afraid for their safety. And so now you can do that more privately. That is a really important contemporary trend in name changing. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Thanks for that call, Sharon. And Kirsten, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this. Have a wonderful day.
You too. That's Kirsten Vermeiglich, professor of history and Jewish studies at Michigan State University, author of the book A Rosenberg by Any Other Name, A History of Jewish Name Changing in America. She's with us today to talk about name changing, how trends in why people change their names have changed over time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.